Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi folks, I'm Jack Kennedy and welcome once again to Farm Tech Talk, the livestock show. Colder weather across most of the country is making for a tricky January in many farmyards. Once again, I'm joined by Adam Woods, Darren Carty and Aidan Brennan to talk all things farming. Later in the show, Adam will be joined by David Corbett from Grassland Agro as normal. To start, I have quickfire questions for Adam, Darren and Aidan. Remember, email your questions to farmtechtalk@farmersjournal.ie or WhatsApp 0868366465. Adam, quick fire for you. The scour one is getting into calf country. I had some trouble with scour last week, particularly crypto. Is it worth going in with the scour vaccine? I'm hearing mixed reports. Adam, talk to me on scour vaccines.
Actually, look, Jack, we could talk about the full show with this, but real quickly, I suppose, crypto, the scour vaccines on the market probably won't specifically protect against crypto. There may be coronavirus and rotavirus they'll protect against. But we'll say out there on farms, people that use the scour vaccine, maybe if they get a bit of crypto, generally it's maybe easier cured, maybe because those secondary infections aren't there. So I'd say if you had issues last year, Jack, to go in with a vaccine, look at it, it's between 10 and 15 euros. But anybody that uses it, finds it really good. We use it on Tullamore. I suppose the big one in colostrum, if you've had crypto problems in the past, look at colostrum is more important than and making sure you're getting adequate colostrum into cows, making cows are calving down with good colostrum. So there's a couple of things there, but I'd still be going in with the vaccine, I think. Yeah,
we might come to some of those in the main show. Adam, Darren, two quick fires for you. Is there any alternative to a feed with soya for feeding in lamb? Yours, I'm being quoted around 500 euros a ton. That's the first one. Talk to me on the soya options.
Yeah, I presume, Jack, he means as a sort of protein source, as is as good as soya. Answer is no, nothing as good as soya, say, provides bypass protein, is high in energy. Yes, there will be feeds that say you can reduce the level of soya by incorporating some rapeseed or some other, say, alternatives, distillers of that with a higher protein content. But in essence, I would be slow to compromise and move away from soya, given the positive impact that it has on colostrum yield and colostrum quality.
Okay, a bit like what Adam was talking about there with the sucklers. Second question for you, Darren. Are factories taking advantage in their pulling of prices, or are things really that bad? Right, that's meant to be a quick fire now, so don't go too far on me.
I think we'll carry that through to the main show, Jack. I don't think we could even start to touch on that now at the moment.
Excellent. Okay, we'll touch up on the main show in a few minutes. Aidan, two quick fires in here again for you. First one, I soil sampled with the department last year and results came back nearly all index 4 for phosphorus P and potassium K, which is completely different to Chagas results over the years. So obviously he got very good results, I call them, on P and K, different to what he got previously from Chagas results, who must have been doing the testing for him before. With the new fertilizer register, will I be able to buy in P and K fertilizer, which I know the land needs to build up as the Chagas results showed? And should I do new soil samples this spring to update things? Thanks. Talk to me, Aidan. There's a bit of kind of debate and discussion around these results that have come back. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the first thing to say, Jack. You know, there does appear to be issues with the results from the department soil sampling, that they're much higher than, you know, farmers would be expecting to get. And some of those results are off the scale now in terms of the level of, you know, the actual milligram per liter in terms of P and less important on the K, but still high. And like, it is a huge issue for farmers then, because they won't have an allowance to spread chemical phosphorus or to import slurry if they're already at index 3s and 4s. So it's a huge problem in these situations, particularly if, as this farmer says, he knows or she knows that they need, you know, to apply more chemical P and K because it's they know mm-hmm. the soils are actually deficient in it. So mm-hmm. I'd say definitely retest. And go to a different lab than, you know, go to a different lab than you went, I suppose, with the department. For me, Jack, it presents, and I might have said it here before, it presents the whole issues around who's, you know, overseeing these labs. Is there quality analysis? Is there quality testing going on? And, you know, the whole control around that.
We might just touch off that in the main show. Excellent, right? Okay. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Oh, I hear you. And the second quick fire that came in for you, Aidan, was ask Aidan what CB value is necessary to deliver a good calf on a crossbred cow.
Okay, it's a difficult one, Jack. It's not really in the lingo yet, this whole CBV, the commercial beef value. But I suppose really the thing to remember is that if you're comparing the beef sub-index within the EBI, the cow, of the dairy cow, so that varies. It could be minus 30 or it could be plus 30. And the lower that is, the more minus that is, the higher you need to be in the commercial beef value for the bull you're using to get a calf that's a reasonably good CBV. And you'd be looking for somewhere, you know, well north of 40 as a, you know, would be a good calf. Some of those really high ones are up to 60, 70. You know, if it's from a high beef mert dairy cow and a high CBV bull. So that's where you're going to get the greatest return there. So I'd be going as high as you can. I'd be looking at, you know, potentially Belgian blues, that type of, you know, I'm using that as an example. That's, you know, a very high CBV.
Okay, excellent. Back to you in a minute. We might again discuss a little bit more around that. There's a lot of information there on the calf focus this week. Adam, I might start with you in what I finished with Aidan there in the quickfire. I mean, CBV values, and Aidan touched off, but the dairy farmers aren't really tuned into the CBV piece. Like, are your guys tuned into the CBV piece, or do they see it as important? Or?
Actually, look, Jack, we shouldn't be talking about CBVs until we start DNA regging calves. There's no point in talking about it. See, CBV is the value of the calf based on the bull that you use and based on the cow that you have. So we can talk about DBI values on bulls, but CBV is the value on the calf. And until we start DNA regging, I don't think we should be even going there. Because I know, right, the CBVs are going to go up on the boards this spring based on a DNA regged calf. But how many calves are going to be DNA regged this spring? And look, we need to have a debate on that. We're kicking that down the road again and again and again, and nobody's grabbing the nettle there and saying, look, let's do this, lads. You know, I'm hearing even Chagas aren't maybe fully, you know, behind it in terms of their own farm. So, you know, serious questions has to be asked there. Why would a farmer do it, I suppose, if best practice, if Chagas are saying best practice it is not to do it? So look, we need to get a few answers there.
Okay, I see on a similar vein, I see you have a piece there on the new Chagas dairy beef research farm or demonstration farm in Tipperary, not far from Halley's farm in Cashin.
Yes, so this is a new farm. It's in partnership with Dawn Meats and Carberry Co-op, and it's a very large farm, 276 acres. Chagas took possession of it back in April, or we'll say the company that's going to run it, which is a combination of Dawn Meats and Carberry Co-op. The idea is here they're going to rear 300 calves on the farm, bring them all through to beef. A lot of the calves will be purchased from Chagas Farms, and there's some contract maintenance done on some of those dairy herds last summer, where just what Aidan has talked about. it might be in terms of going in with high, you know, DBI stars to end up with a calf with a high CBV value of 4 stars or greater. So I guess maybe that'll you know, put some of that language into dairy farmers' circles in terms of trying to breed better calves. Big targets here in terms of slaughter age. You know, you're looking at 17 months for heifers, 18, 19 months for the bullocks coming off that farm. So yeah, it's at the very start of it. It's a 15-year lease. It's massive, I suppose. That's the only thing I'd say from a point of view of maybe I see on the ground talking to beef farmers that we've more and more we see suckler farmers with their whatever 10 or 20 cows, and they're actually, you know, we said before, open to the idea of rearing 10 cows, but whether that'll be relative to go down to Feathered, which is you know, really good land and a really good part of the country, whether my people in Leitrim and Cavan will associate themselves with that sort of a system, I suppose that is to be questioned. But it'll be interesting to watch it to see what targets can be met down there.
Okay, lots more on calves in the focus this week. Adam, like, it's fair to say we don't often get the chance to talk about positivity in the beef trade, like, but you have it up front this week in the paper. There's a real sense that there is positive trends happening in the beef markets currently, and there's more still to come.
Absolutely, look at it. Do your heart good to be talking to guys this week as regards finishing and outlooks. And went up to the Borbia meat marketing conference last Friday morning in Nace, and look at everybody there. You know, a real sense of positivity in the room up there. And every speaker almost on the morning mentioned China and the possibilities of China. You know, Phil O'Neill has it this week in terms of even more possibilities with China. The USDA forecasts back in October they've overshot the runway, and that, or sorry, they've undershot the runway in terms of they reckon now an extra 675,000 ton of beef will be required in China for 2023. Like, and to put that into context, Ireland's complete exports is somewhere around 500,000 tons. So the possibilities of this market is really endless. And just on that, we're hearing sort of with at the moment, we wrote a story a couple of weeks ago about, you know, 1 in 4 cattle now being killed out of feedlots, we'll say on a weekly basis in 2022. Well, the implications of that now are a lot of those feedlots are TB control units, so they're not free of TB as such. So China eligible cattle have to be from a TB free herd for 12 months. So that counts those larger feedlots ineligible for the Chinese market. That means that the smaller farmer, that it could be actually good for the smaller finisher here. And we're hearing talk there are some processors entering the market at 15 or 20 cents of a bonus for China eligible cattle. They'll need to pay that to get them because they won't be able to knock on the door of their usual larger finishers in terms of getting those cattle. So all very, very positive there. And look, a beef price kicking on again, you know, 5.30 for heifers this week. We're probably up 5 cent. Cows really, really good, and yeah, that's filtered down to the MARP trade. If we look at MARP bids analysis this week, we're looking at 180 euros of an increase in the last 4 weeks on the 650 plus kilo animals. So it's filtering back to the MARP's insatiable appetite, talking to MARP managers around MARP rings in terms of from factory agents. They can't get the cattle out in farms, so they're in around the rings waving their hands looking for those cattle. So it's all, yeah, bar a banana skin somewhere, Jack. I'd never be as confident as a beef price kicking on.
Right, I've never seen such positivity. And yet, Adam, to kind of keep it in context, like, we're what are we talking about in terms of kind of like, I mean, remember we had that discussion maybe just prior to Christmas in terms of winter finishers, what they needed. Like, they needed, I think we said that figure of 6 euros a kilo, you know, for the end of January, early February or something. Did we say that? And that, like,
we did.
It's not an all-out bonanza, like, you know what I mean?
It's not. No, absolutely not. No, and I shouldn't get caught up in all that. But I suppose it happens that infrequently that sometimes you get caught up in it. But yeah, our bigger probably finishers are probably on that. You know, in terms of loyalty bonuses of 10 and 20 cent, and if we're on a 4.30 base this week, we're probably plus 20 there for quality assurance is 5.50. Plus grading is another 10 or 12, you know, up 5.62. And then adding your loyalty bonus, you're up at 5.85. So speaking to the larger finishers, look, it's not too bad there. But yeah, you're right. Look, at 6 euros was a break even there. So we need to be close to that as possible.
Yeah, okay. No, fair play.
Don't wreck me, Buzz. Like, just
no, sorry. And I didn't mean to. Like, I just hear these suckler farmers. Maybe I'm so used to them here and giving out. But yet, you know, I mean, it's not.
No,
like,
no, you're right.
You know, we have to put it in context. It's not like the dairy farmers, in fairness, and they're not afraid to say it. Like, are making good money because prices are good, costs are increasing. Yes, you know, the kind of a way. So it's just to put it in context and be real about it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's all. No. Yeah, but no, look, I hate wrecking your Buzz. Like, Adam, that's that's the markets, that's beef prices where we are. Like, I mean, in terms of what's happening on farms, in terms of, you know, a lot of farmers may be up in feed levels now, like an up in concentrate levels now before, you know what I mean? And giving them a heavy concentrate. Feed prices are still relatively high and look like kind of staying up, Adam, do they?
They do, I suppose. In a more global scale, maybe there was a speaker from Rabobank, again, at that Borbia conference on Friday morning, and she talked about, you know, in general, feed prices may be tracking downward, but it always takes a couple of weeks or months for that to filter through the farms, because obviously mills buy forward and they buy maybe at different times of the year or whatever, so it'll take a wee bit but in terms of coming down the line, I suppose we can look forward to, I'd say, reduced feed prices. Yeah, but at the moment you're talking, look at Jack, 420, 430, we're stepping up the bulls in Tullamore Farm now, so it's getting into, you know, a more expensive time, I suppose, out on farms. Look at getting ready for calving, you know, we're coming to the end of January, it doesn't be long coming around, and on Suckler Farm, some of those earlier calving farms, you know, getting ready with a scour vaccine. Sean has been power washing calving pens down there, moving some of the cows back onto straw where they have where they're feeding on slats but laying on straw just for a couple of weeks there before calving starts. So yeah, we're just getting ready, I suppose, being prepared for calving.
I on a simple one, I'll leave you on this now. My Suckler buddy, like he was talking to me, he was saying, he says, I have a bullock or two bullocks too many in some of the pens, he says, and honest to God, he says, I reckon, he says, it's impacting on the performance of all the animals in the pen. Like, I mean, he says, I would have probably been better to kind of take out one or two animals and have it so that there was just the seven or eight animals in the pen rather than the nine or ten that he was trying to accommodate. You know?
Which, Jack, he's in a super position in terms of that mouth trade at the moment, like in terms of pulling out one or two. Like, upwards of €3, €3.20, €3.30 a kilo for beef animals. That's the equivalent of 580 kilo carcass there in some marts this week. So, you know, there's no excuse there almost for offload. No, absolutely not. Absolutely.
Thanks, Adam. Darren, maybe if I start with you in terms of the positivity, can we soak any of that positivity from the beef farmers into the sheep market side of things? Like, is it as good? Is the prognosis as good?
Unfortunately not, Jack. Another 20 cent a kilo quoted the start of the week. Base prices 580 in the two Irish country meat plants, and a lot of the other plants not quoting officially, somewhere around 596 euros. It does seem to have sort of stabilized now. When I say stabilized, it's at a very low level. And a lot of, I suppose, maybe uncertainty around what's happening, what's going to happen. Some of the factories would say that demand in export markets is very poor at the minute. We've seen a similar situation happen this time last year where there was a two-week sort of lull period, but not quite as, I suppose, as bad as this, in that you're starting from a lower base and the prices this time last year were 50 to 70 cent a kilo higher. Right. You also have then the added complication of input costs being so much higher that anybody finishing lambs are killing them at the moment. Like, they're in a break-even situation at best and possibly loss-making finishing lambs.
I see some of my buddies that are grazing off rape crops and forage crops, like we'll say, and now the lambs look dirty. Like, they're obviously, as you told me before, they're going to have to bring them in for a week before they let them go, you know. But they're not making money so darn at current prices where they are, like.
No, very, very, well, sorry. Some of those, Jack, say they might have a slightly lower, cost basis. But I suppose what has really aggravated the thing has been performance has been poor this year on grazing off those crops. Now, poor relative to other years. It's been also poor in grassland, given just this, how challenging weather is. And should we see that again this week with snow? Like, sheep don't mind cold, dry weather, but like, they've had an awful December. Bad start to January, and again now more sort of wet sort of weather again. And anybody that's not feeding fairly high levels of meat, lambs just aren't performing. Now, you would hope that the markets would follow like last year, and that you would see an increase towards the end of the month. The caveat to this, Jack, is there's reports of a lot of New Zealand lamb being in the market. Now, I talked to a lot of the processors this week, and I talked to some of the other, processors across the water to see what they were seeing. And while we all see, say, New Zealand lamb in the English market, there's a lot of reports of it in the European market. But as of yet, the visibility of that isn't massive. There's a lot of talk about lamb being underway, a lot of talk about, say, New Zealand diverting higher volumes, but there's also talk about this, whether them volumes have left, is if some of that lamb will actually materialise and come into this market. But look, it's very early days, and look, that's causing a lot of volatility to the market. What I'd say is that if that lamb didn't come, it would allow the market to recover quicker. If that lamb does materialise in the market, unfortunately, this could prolong for longer than what we've thought.
Okay, so I call it a tricky time in terms of just where the market is at the moment. And I suppose the little bit of vision that we have is not exactly clear either in terms of where it's going to go for the year. So, that's where it is. You're calling it straight. And that's the information that you have available to you at the moment.
Yeah.
Darren, if I was to...
I should have also said just before you move on, and sorry for cutting across here, that there is a meeting 8 o'clock in that loan on Monday night. It's organised by the IFA. Chagas will have, say, updated figures on the costs of producing lambs, market insights from Boar Beer and Irish Country Meats. Kevin Comiskey will be talking on behalf of farmer representatives. Okay. So, that in itself, I think, look at it, in anything like this...
Darren, is that a crisis price meeting kind of a thing, is it?
Yeah, exactly, Jack. Yeah, it's right. A sort of crisis thing around where the industry is going, and hopefully look at it and shed some light, because the worrying thing, I have a piece in the Sheep Pages this week, and since in the last 5 years, consumption is in Europe has gone down by over 40,000 tons, and that's a fact, so that is a worrying element. So this, anything that I suppose gets people talking around the table around what can be done or brings more transparency to the situation has to be good.
Okay, excellent. No, that's clear. It's good to flag that, as you say, in terms of where it is. And if guys want more information, they can tag on to that. Darren, in terms of just to maybe do a quick roundup of the schemes in terms of what we learned this week, in addition to what we knew, if it was anything new, we had a great meeting in Ballina in Mayo on earlier on the week. We'll say it was a good crowd there and plenty of questions, I suppose, again on the various schemes. Acres, first of all, Darren, it's a quick one to box it off, the 16,000.
Yeah.
Did we gain any more information in terms of is the 16,000 are going to get into Acres?
No, the only thing we gained is a timeline, and they say that the department are working through them, and they have a timeline set up to start of February to have information out to farmers. And I think, look, there's pressure on the department on that because it has knock-on effects on all the other schemes. And we did see where the department were doing talk in previous meetings around maybe an open date of the start of February or to mid-February for schemes such as BISEC or schemes young farmers. They're now possibly saying that that'll be late February. And that's as a result of Acres, and it's also having a knock-on effect. So I think the department are keen to advance that to avoid having a knock-on effect. And we've seen similar with TAMS. We talked, I think, in Cork, Jack, about TAMS opening in January. And the IT resources for that, I think John Muldowney said this week, Acres sucked up all of those IT resources. And we're now seeing that has been pushed back.
Okay. Now, did I still pick up in terms of the TAMS that they're still, did John say that they're still hoping for that April kind of, I suppose, tranche to activate? Is it'll open in the next maybe 2 or 3 weeks and it'll close in early April, middle of April?
That's exactly it, Jack. So what John was saying is that they want to try as far as possible to keep on sort of that sort of 3 months rolling tranche thing, or the tranches that they had in the past. Historically, there would have been one in April. So you would say that that's a positive in itself, that if they're going to operate on that, they're going to leave a significant period, or you'd hope a significant period for farmers to apply. He did also, he did also say that they would have more information in the coming weeks. I presume that's going to be around, say, what items are there, around the term schemes and conditions. And even if we got foresight of that, farmers could start to be working through in advance of, say, the actual application IT system opening. So I think that could even be an option as well, is that we might see some of the information coming, even if it's in advance of actually being able to submit an application.
Okay. Anything else new on the scheme front worth flagging, Darren?
No, I think, look at this, talking to some of the lads there, Fran Moran, David Buckley and John, I think the message I got is that farmers should be doing all that they can to get themselves accustomed. I have the scheme's timeline in the inside back page this week. And one of the messages I think we took from is that even if they're looking at Space for Nature and looking at them estimates and looking at see whether them maps are marked correctly, that in itself could be a job that could be done in advance of schemes opening. And also in advance, if we know, Jack, that February will creep up very quick. Calving is already ramping up for dairy farmers. Lambing will be coming. So any of those things that farmers can get a stab on or get started at, it's to be recommended.
Thanks, Darren. Aidan, to come to you, and maybe just to pick up on where we were in terms of the quick fire job, you were just talking about, I suppose we were talking about the CBV value on calves and where guys need to be. I mean, it has started, the campaign has started in terms of calving for most of your guys, Ed.
Yeah, most might be a bit of a stretch, Jack. A lot of them have started, particularly down south, where we tend to have earlier calving anyway, because the grass growth season starts earlier down south. But I mean, for most lads in kind of the Midlands and north, you know, just literally a week away. We had the grassland during the week and I was down there and most farmers I met hadn't started calving yet, so that's a fair indication of where the country is at. But it's going to get very busy very quickly. As soon as it starts now, it'll be hell for leather for at least 3 to 4 weeks, then it'll ease off a bit then in March. But the calving rates now will be very high. You know, you have more cows and farms, compact calving, you know, and short gestation bulls as well, so they'll come quickly.
I was talking to someone about that during the week, Aidan, and he was talking to me that there's he reckons like in the last 5 years the shift to using more drugs to synchronize heifers or cows is real in terms of that compaction piece, like, you know, in terms of, you know, mostly probably heifers, in fairness, maiden heifers and synchronize them so that they calve compactly. I hadn't realized it was that significant. I said to him, is it 50 or 60% of your clients? He said, yeah, very definitely. Is drug usage, I'm asking you off the cuff like here, but is drug usage to synchronize as big as that, do you reckon?
It is, yeah. But I don't think it's having an impact on calving rates, right? So my theory is they're using the drugs and the heifers because they don't want to put the time into AIing the heifers. But, right, you know, because typically you have to either do 3 or 4 weeks of AI when you're watching the whole time or do the 11 days. So, you're watching for 3 days, then you stick in the PG and then you watch them again for 3 or 4 days after that. But it's all time consuming. So guys are now, a lot of like the 50% figure, it could even be higher than that, are now using the Cedar program or the two shots of PG to compact it in. But like they're still only getting 60 to 70% conception rate only. Now it's good, you know, conception rate. So they're not calving any more heifers in the first 3 or 4 weeks as they would ordinarily with the ordinary AI programs, without any synchronization. So I don't think it's a cause of cows calving earlier. Put it that way.
Okay, I hear you. So I hadn't been aware that, as you say, that Cedar program. Like, I mean, back in my day, like the watch for 6 days or 7 days and give the shot of PG was probably the kind of the most used method of synchronization. But you were saying now it has stepped up a gear. Like
it has, yeah. And go to the discussion group meetings now, at least 50% will be using nearly all Cedars and heifers. And that's really only happened in the last couple of years and probably driven by Chagas. You know, Chagas research has been on it and some Chagas researchers are promoting it. And indeed, they're promoting it on the use in dairy cows as well, which is an area that I think it's, you know, I wouldn't be keen on using it in dairy cows too much. Okay, in your problem cows, that's a different matter altogether. But I wouldn't be keen on healthy cows. Some of them are using it for the sex semen as well, of course. They want to get all their, you know, the cows that are suitable for sex semen in terms of lactation, age from, or date from calving. And they want to, you know, run them, you know, all sex semen the first day or maybe a few days before their main start of the breeding season. But like if you're relying on hormones to get cows and calf, fine for 1 or 2 years, but run that over a long period of time, 20, 30 years, what's going to happen to, you know, is the genetics going to change and is natural selection going to be eroded somewhat? And we've seen that in other industries, like it's big in Australia, Jack. You go over there and it's hormones galore. Some parts of New Zealand is the same thing. And in New Zealand, they've kind of moved back away from it a little bit. Which is probably no harm.
I hear you. No, I agree, and I agree with your long term piece on it. So yeah, no, it was. Is there You were obviously lucky enough to be at the positive for 2 days. I was only there for a half day last week, Aidan, and I came in on the back of Joe Leonard, the Mead dairy farmer Joe Leonard, who has a good bit of experience in multi-species swards, and Trevor Gilliland, the researcher, will say, who has worked a lot in the past in terms of seeds, grass seeds, and multi-species swards. I mean, it was a good session, I felt, Aidan, in terms of, I suppose, you know, contextualizing the whole piece around multi-species, and that it isn't the kind of fix-all solution that has kind of maybe been proposed in some places. Like, I mean, that was just one session. I'm sure there was that stood out for me. I'm sure there was other pieces that stood out for you.
Sure, there was, Jack. I'm writing this week on the session that was after that, on in terms of the role of partners in farming. So this is, you know, typically a husband and wife. It's something that's after coming to light, I suppose, because the Dairy Women's Ireland group has been set up, and I suppose these are some of the issues that I suppose women who have joined dairy farming because their husbands are dairy farmers, and some of the challenges that they've experienced along the road. And you have to acknowledge it's very different marrying a farmer versus marrying a solicitor or a doctor or a shopkeeper or something like that. Like, because you're marrying into family business, number one, the husband inherits the business typically, and you're also marrying into the you know, obviously everyone marries into the family, but you're marrying into, you know, in very close proximity. Because oftentimes the farmers, the males' parents are living very close or in the same house. You have to deal with all that. You have to deal with the expectation that comes with it. And some of that is, as Marion Beecher, the Chagas researcher who's speaking at us, said, some of that is explained and communicated. And moreover, it isn't communicated at all. You're just expected to pick up on it. So women like who have experienced this find it challenging. They often have to then give up their own careers because the farm gets busy and childcare becomes an issue and all these kind of, you know, problems. And look, I mean, you might people probably listening in are probably saying, what's he on about? Like, we've all our mothers have to experience this, but, you know, future generations mightn't, you know, might balk at this. And what's going to happen then to the farm business? And I suppose really the session, the highlight for me was that we need to acknowledge that this is, you know, challenging for female partners in many cases. And, you know, we put steps and strategies in order to make it easier, better, and make farms more attractive. And, you know, for the male in the relationship, they need to recognize it and come up with, I suppose, you know, working with your wife and living with, you know, your life partner, that it has to work out on all sides.
No, absolutely. 100%. It's fair to say, Aidan, I meant to say to start, you were just starting in terms of on the quickfire piece, going into the whole piece around P&K, and that the soil results were coming back higher for a lot of farms than they had been in the past. And you were just making the point, and I cut you off and I said we'll come to it in the main show, in terms of the labs and the kind of regulatory piece around them, in terms of that to make sure consistent, make sure results are consistent and high quality, etc. Like, I mean, do you feel there's a serious gap there? Like, we don't have too many labs, like.
No, so if you go back, I don't know when, I can't remember the exact dates, but Chagas used to have a lab themselves, right? I think it was based in Johnston Castle. You'd know more now with this. And they used to test, I'd say maybe, I don't know, I'm only guessing, but like 80-90% of all the samples that were taken in the country, they were testing them. They don't test any soil samples now, bar their own, as far as I understand. They mightn't even test their own. So it's been outsourced, right? And that's not a bad thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. But that's what it is. But who then is doing the quality control on those labs? And ever before there was a department, you know, a soil sampling scheme, I would have heard some farmers say, oh, such and such a lab in such and such an area, the results are all wrong. I've heard Chagas advisors saying, I wouldn't go testing, you know, soil samples there. I go somewhere else because the results are just wrong. You know, they know they're wrong. So like, whose role is it? For me, I think it's the Department of Agriculture. They need to be out, you know, testing quality control on soil sampling labs. And I'm not saying is there issues or not. Well, there obviously is.
Yeah, I was just want to make that point. I mean, we're casting aspersions. On labs without kind of any concrete evidence, but the anecdotal evidence is there, and this recent piece on the P&K results coming back far higher than they've got before, that seems to be relatively widespread. Are a lot of people, a lot of farmers to talk to me.
And I don't know, are those did I hear that lab is in England, or some of those labs were in the UK or something? I don't know where the department testing was. It all done in Ireland? I'm not sure. So I'm not just saying all Irish labs, but just you know, for me, it's like in take milk, Jack. You know, so there's a Moorpark in that area, so they send samples every week with the specific fat and protein level that they've tested, you know, with their test, with their, yeah. I think it's by hand, the old-fashioned way down there, yeah. so they know it's right. And yeah. They send that to all the milk processors in Ireland, and their milk testing laboratories that they pay farmers on need to have the exact same results as what the chocolate sample is on. And yes. that's done every week. Now, yeah. do we need to do something the same for soil sampling? That's what I'd say. It's so important yeah. now. There's so much, you know, it before it was for management purposes. Now it's a regulatory yes. tool. We've seen what the department are using it for in terms of the nitrates. Everything is riding on these results, and we need them to be 100% correct.
Yeah, 100% point made. Aidan, I'll finish up. You had more. You had another conference fix this week. The Grassland conference is on. Big conference down south.
Yeah, a big crowd at this again, Jack. You know, there always is at the Grassland. Look, it's a good day, good technical day out, you have to say. Good updates on managing with low nitrogen, input. So we had Michael Deneen talking about red clover silage. With Michael Egan talking, these are all Chagas researchers, Michael Egan talking about white clover swards. And then you have Robert O'Dea, a dairy farmer from Limerick, talking about how he manages his swards. So I'd say, Jack, at this stage, he's one of the top white clover farmers in the country. He's managed to grow high levels of grass while reducing his chemical nitrogen, and he's at it a good few years. So, greater updates there. We had Noreen Lacey from IFAC. She gave a talk on the impact of nitrates directive, the changes there. And look, for a farmer in the high band, right, her analysis, farmer in the high band, so over 6,500 kilos of milk per year, that farmer will have to reduce his cow numbers from 100 on a 40 hectare farm from 112 cows currently to 83 if it goes down to 220. And the profit reduction is 53%. So a huge reduction in profit because of that, because just hasn't got the land to carry the cows. We have two nitrate meetings coming up, important to say, in Cavan on the 24th of January, which is next Tuesday.
Tuesday.
And then just Tuesday, isn't it?
Yeah, next and Tuesday.
Then,
yeah.
And then the one in Port Leash then on the 26th, which is on next Thursday. They're both at 7:30. They can register in the Farmers Journal and free to attend. Ted Massey, the senior inspector in the Department of Agriculture, will be at both of them. Representatives of IFA and ourselves in the journal will be giving a talk as well on what the implications are and what farmers need to do to prepare for these massive changes coming.
Perfect, Aidan. Thanks for that. Chat to you again next week. Folks, earlier I flagged that Adam had a chat with David Corbett from Grassland Agro. Let's have a listen.
Okay, I'm delighted to be joined by David Corbett, Product Manager with Grassland Agro. David, I suppose up here in Cavan, we're still closed out from hooking up slurry tankers, but down south, they're on the road, and I've met a couple of them in the last couple of days. But just in terms of making best use of slurry, I suppose, in terms of some farmers maybe talking about maybe reducing fertilizer or maybe keeping an eye on fertilizer purchases, in terms of making the best use of slurry, what's your top tips there around making the best use of it?
Yeah, that's right, Adam. Yeah, look, majority of the country is open now for slurry spreading. Things don't look too bad now above in Cavan there. The blue skies and cows grazing in the background. Yeah. Ground conditions look fairly good now for slurry, Adam. But there are, to be fair, you've seen them yourselves. There's tankers, there's umbilical systems there going galore all across the country. And look, tanks are full. But look, I would say, make best use out of that slurry, Adam. That is the number one. And it's easy to say that in theory, myself and yourself sitting here across from each other on the screen. It's grand to say make best use out of it, put it where you need it. But I know when tanks are full and you need to get out with it and the contractor's coming into the yard, look, it's hard to justify not putting out a large quantity of it. But just maybe one of those big figures, Jack, and every farmer should have this figure at the forefront now, at the top of their head going forward, is that 1,000 gallons of slurry is worth about 50 to 55 euro. So 1,000 gallons of slurry. So that is colossal money, Adam. 1,000 gallons of slurry, 55 euro. So use that slurry sparingly. What I would say is just think about the slurry and think back to last year when you were going with that slurry, Adam, because ideally, and in an ideal situation, that slurry will go back to where the silage came from. And if you're on a highly stocked farm, a highly stocked milking platform, chances are that slurry was brought in the farm grate from an out block or from rented ground or whatever would be from that side is blocked. Ideally, that side is will or that slurry will go back there. Look, that's not reality either. It is going out on the grazing platform, though, be it beef stock or sucklers or dairy. That is the reality. Very valuable product, and use it as we need it. Look, I suppose currently ground conditions are probably questionable. We went from a very wet spell into quite a hard spell, I suppose. And I have talked to a few farmers and that around the country, and a lot of contractors going very early now in the morning just to make the most out of those ground conditions, because I suppose you just have a bit of hardness there on the ground and it is making it a bit easier to travel. But look, if ground, look, it's simple as that. You know, if there's water sitting on ground, don't go with slurry there. Although you might be in a dry part of the country, if there's water there, that slurry is going to go with it, because that water has to go somewhere. So look, just be conscious of that, Adam, because look, we can get into this a bit more detail, but look, if we're not more conscious about where we use these nutrients, things are going to change big time.
So like there's a lot of farmers, especially up here, maybe would treat slurry as a waste and it's hassle to get rid of it, and you know, you wait till the summer months maybe and stuff like that. So you're saying to really sit down and take a look as to what fields maybe require it, or what fields has the highest nutrient requirements, and yeah, then plan it out based on that. Is there differences, would say majority of farms have a couple of slatted sheds, maybe they're ranging from weanlings to dry cows, maybe on beef farms you're finishing animals in sheds. In terms of getting slurry tested, is it worth doing that, or is there different values on different tanks on farms, or what's the findings there?
It is, of course, Adam. Like a 1,000 gallons of slurry, as I said, is worth about €55, right? You get a slurry sample tested for mineral analysis for about €60. So you're talking for one, just for testing your slurry, you're talking 1,000 gallons of slurry. I know myself at home trying to empty a tank, and there could be 1,000 gallons left inside in it, and you're doing a little victory lap around the field trying to empty it. Like, you know, there's 1,000 gallons of slurry wasted here and there. You're only talking that the value of 1,000 gallons of slurry just to test it. So definitely worthwhile, Adam. If your system hasn't changed that much, Adam, so if you haven't changed your strategy around fertilizing silage ground, chances are your nutrient value in that slurry is not going to change that much year on year. So if you did test slurry last year, personally, I think it's not going to change that much this year. So look, for peace of mind, definitely worthwhile with the value of slurry at the moment. But what I would say, if you are doing a nutrient analysis on the slurry, get it tested, right? Sooner rather than later. Test that slurry, and what you can do then going forward is maybe use a hydrometer, so a slurry hydrometer, and that will tell you your dry matter. I know chalkers have done a lot of work in trying to predict the value of slurry, so the NPK value of slurry based on dry matter, and it's, okay, it's very closely correlated. So the higher your dry matter, the more nutrient value is in that slurry. So a 6-7% dry matter slurry probably worth about the equivalent of a bag of 5-5-30 in terms of NPK. So that's your standard, maybe 6-7% dry matter slurry. So what I would say, Adam, if you do have a slurry analysis, use your dry matter then. So get a slurry hydrometer, and every time you go putting out that slurry, just test the dry matter, and then you have an indication of how much NP and K is going out with that particular sample or tank, because to be fair, your dry matter is going to change. So if you're putting out slurry now, that dry matter is going to change compared to, you know, if it's for the second cut. So, you know, it might be a bit more water down, and you can adjust for that then if you do know the dry matter.
In terms of rates, David, like is what rate should people be sort of targeting maybe for, or is there different rates then if you're going to silage ground, if you want to graze it maybe off, then should you be going with a lighter rate, or if you're going out on the paddocks, so you better go with a trail and shoe to try and get you in there then to graze it again within a shorter time frame?
Yeah, look, I think at the moment, 2,000 gallons for me would be the cutoff point. I wouldn't be advising any farm to go over that 2,000 gallons, Adam. Look, if you're worried about graze outs, you can be sure that there's going to be a shower of rain between now and when you go grazing. And if there's not, I don't know. I'd be very surprised anyway, if there's not. So there's no worry about that, of that slurry, you know, sticking to the leaf. You know, we're in that time of year now where rainfall is never too far away. Look, 2,000 gallons, I would use that as the cutoff point, because look, ground ground is not far off saturated at the moment, and I would say a majority of the country. So look, the ground can manage a whole lot of slurry. One of our own, John O'Loughlin, you would have talked to him a few times yourself, Adam. He actually put up a tweet the other day, which was taken by one of our own agronomists, Noel Hamill. And Noel took this picture last year, and it was where slurry went out in the springtime at very high rates. And you can see how damaging that was for the ground. A lot of earthworms coming up and dead earthworms. And that is an issue, Adam, because the earthworm is what's keeping our soil alive. And you could be sure if the earthworms were coming up dead, that has a big impact on the rest of the biology in that ground. So it's just something to keep in mind.
In terms of the weather, then we'll say you have weather, I suppose, pre-spreading, and you're looking. We talked about, you know, knocking out on waterlogged ground, knocking out on frozen ground, making sure that everything's right there and getting the best value for it. On the day that you're actually spreading itself, the research, is it still the same around sort of if it's a sunny, windy day, you're better maybe not going out, or is it still sort of damp, dull days that you're better, you get the best sort of payback from the slurry spreading it on those days?
You do, of course, yeah, you do, of course. So, look, if you go with your low emission slurry spreading, you could be getting maybe an extra 3 units of nitrogen per 1,000 gallons. So, if you're going with 2,000 gallons, you could potentially be getting an extra 6 units of nitrogen. Like, 6 units of nitrogen could grow you, in terms of grass, six units of nitrogen will support about maybe 300-400 kilos of dry matter. And that's a lot of grass in the springtime. You know, when if you're at a heavy stocking rate and there's a big demand, a lot of mouths to feed, that is a lot of grass. So just keep that in mind as well. Trying to utilize as much of that as we possibly can. Look, it's not as much of an issue because look, the weather is not as threatening in the springtime in terms of volatilization, what you were talking about there, Adam. But look, still in all, we are going to get much better efficiency out of that nitrogen in the slurry if we can go with that low emission slurry spreading. And look, I think just the simple thing is it's similar to urea. So like we use a urea based product in the springtime is because it's a lot more protected in the ground. So you apply urea and it can potentially sit there for maybe 5 or 6 weeks, depending on ground conditions. And that is because the ground has the ability to hold on to that urea and ammonium. So there is conversions there until it gets to nitrate. Obviously, nitrate is not the preferred option because it's very vulnerable in the ground, very vulnerable for loss. And it's the same thing with the slurry, Ninja. When you go with that slurry, it can and is protected in the ground, and it has the ability, especially the nitrogen, to be bound to those soil particles until it is needed. So that's why using a low emission slurry spread, getting the slurry I suppose as quick as you can, getting that contact with the soil and with the ground is very important to help retain as much of that nitrogen as possible.
Okay, David, some really useful advice there and really timely advice. And look, we're all praying up here in Cavan for a dry 2 weeks that we can hook up the spreaders on the 1st of February. So look, thanks very much for joining us today. And I'm sure you'll be back on with more advice in the coming weeks. Thanks, David.
Right, folks, that's it for another week. Thanks for watching and indeed for listening. Thanks to Adam and David for that chat. Thanks to all our own specialists, Adam, Darren and Aidan. Remember, you can listen back to any of the recent webinars or podcasts on ifj.ie/podcast. Thanks to Grassland Agro for helping us to make this show happen. We'll be back again next week. Until then, stay safe and safe farming.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itsinas.
I'm Kayla Itsinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.